Thank you for listening to this podcast brought to you by the Center for Christian Music Studies at Baylor University. This podcast was recorded at the 2012 Alleluia Conference. For more information about Alleluia, visit our website where you will find conference dates and details, audio and video recordings, and a list of confirmed clinicians for next summer's event. For this information and more, visit us online at www.baylor.edu/alleluia.
Becoming a musical extrovert, that's a dopey title. It's just about the best that I could come up with. The point of it is, and I'm really kind of trying to say a lot of the same thing that Mary said, is that when we play, we want to be pianists that not only get the notes right, but actually reach people and minister to people. And we've all heard pianists play, and we've kind of said, they play pretty well, but you know, they're just kind of mechanical. You know, it's there's just not any heart and any soul in that. And then we also hear pianists like Mary play and pianists like Joe play. And I think that most of us probably agree we want to be closer to their model than the more mechanical kind of model. I deal with this a lot as a teacher. You know, I see a lot of students who are really concerned about hitting the right notes. And you can tell when they play that's what's on their mind. And to be honest with you, I struggle with that a little bit. Maybe not so much anymore because my school days are way behind me. But, well, not too way behind me. I'm maybe not that old, but they're far enough behind me that, you know, I'm not worried about piano juries anymore. But, you know, the school mentality, if you've ever been through and you've had piano lessons at a college or if you've, I've been a piano major or done competitions, it's easy to kind of fall into the mindset of the playing has to be perfect. You know, I mean, I've got a jury of, my faculty members that are back there, and I got to get it right because I've got to get that A. And when you go through that, it's easy to kind of lose track of some of the things Mary was talking about because you're just programmed into getting the right notes. One of the reasons that I programmed this session, and also one of the reasons I was so glad to hear what Mary said, is because honestly, I'm transparent with you guys. I'm kind of going through a little bit of that right now. I've written an offertory book, a book of piano solos, which is going to be coming out. And you guys were in the arranging session, so you know that. And in about 2 weeks, I'm going to be recording them. And Joe is going to produce the thing, Joe Martin. Well, so I'm going to be up there playing, you know, my arrangements for him, and you know what kind of pianist he is. And so, to be honest, I'm sitting here thinking as I'm practicing these, I got to get the right notes. I got to do this. I got to do that. I got to do this. And so it was so wonderful to hear what Mary had to say. You know, that getting the right notes is not really all that there is. That's kind of the first starting point, but there's not really any. It goes a lot deeper than that. Well, I put together my session because I know some of the things that I'm having to do right now to kind of get myself ready for that recording and be able to go in and record music and not record just a bunch of notes. And so these are ideas that I've worked on with my students. They're ideas right now, frankly, that I'm working on with myself. And so I thought it might be fun to just kind of share a couple of them. So we're probably going to be a little bit more technical than what Mary was. But, you know, we're both after the same thing, and if she can kind of, like I said, be a cheerleader, maybe I can give you some more hands-on things to do. The first thing that's on our sheet, let's see, other than the little blurb there that says introduction, a few ways to come out of your shell at the piano. Well, pray and prepare. I'm probably not going to spend a lot of time here on this because I think Mary has covered it very adequately. If you're going to be doing any kind of ministry in the church, whether it's, you know, a pianist or an accompanist or a pastor, everything that you do, you know, it really does have to be bathed in prayer. So I think that we all know that. I can speak for a minute just on the prepare issue. You know, I'm assuming that probably, you know, people that you guys that are listening are a lot like all of us because we all deal with the same performance issues When you're at the piano, you don't want it to be a performance. You want it to be ministry for people, and you want to get beyond, you want to project the emotions and the feelings that you have and the message that God's given you. You want to project that to the audience, but a lot of times it's hard to do that. At least it seems like for me. So I can speak just for a second about the preparation before we move into some other more hands-on things. Obviously, the more prepared you are with a piece, the more comfortable you're going to be with kind of putting all the, you know, the worries about, am I going to get a wrong note? I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. You can put all that behind you. So I advocate serious preparation. And I feel like, actually, that that's something that's lacking across the board in a lot of church music. Isn't it a shame? I mean, I think it's a shame. And if you guys think of it for a second, I bet you'll agree with me that the world expects higher quality music out of its secular entertainers than we expect out of the church. Now, okay, I mean, those are professional musicians. And they are the top of their game, top best in the world. And in our choirs are stocked with, you know, volunteer, you know, musicians. So, yeah, of course, I guess, you know, theoretically that's a nice thing to say, that the church should be as good as the world's entertainment. But we know that in real life it's probably not going to happen. But I do think that we ought to prepare for it, you know, just like those guys do, right? You know, I think that in a lot of our churches, whether it's playing an offertory or getting ready for choir rehearsal, you know, we sit there and say, oh, you know, we're not really great at this, but we're going to do it the best we can, and we're going to pray over it, and God's going to bless it anyway. And He will, and He does. But, you know, in my mindset, how much more if we prepare something to the utmost, absolute best we can, and then we bring it to Him as a gift, and as an offering, a sacrifice to Him, how much more could He take that and bless that, right? It's not performing, right? It's not about performing and glorifying yourself. It's about carrying it to the, honoring God by developing your gifts the best that you can, and preparing to be the best minister that you can, and then you getting out of the way, you know, and letting God choose to minister through you. So I love the idea of preparation. And you know, it's too bad, really, that the world expects more out of secular entertainers and musicians than it does out of the church. You know, that really wasn't always the case. You know, if you study church history, and really if you study music history, you'll know that through the medieval times, that the church, and even into the 1700s, into the Baroque period, the time of Bach, the church was the center of the community. You know, and musicians, principalities and rulers and nobility and clergymen, they would compete for the best musicians because they wanted to have the best music in town. I mean, and that might not be a very godly goal. Like, you know, I don't know if they were wanting the best musicians, you know, for real very good reasons, or where they could say, hey, we've got the best musicians. But the point is that the church was the center, you know, and as you study history and you study church history and music history, you see that kind of moving away from the church, you know. So it's too bad. Historically, the church would have been the place where the finest music around would have been heard, and it would be nice, you know, if that was still the case. Okay, enough of that. Let's go into some things that you can do at the piano. And again, I probably am not going to approach these from a very spiritual aspect because I feel like that's been covered. These are a little bit more pianistic things, but please know that everything that I say, the spiritual aspect is certainly behind it. Exaggerate. What do you think I mean by that? When I come to the piano, I can't tell you how many times I have played pieces and I have felt like I have laid my heart and soul into it. And then I hear a recording of it, and you know, it just kind of sounds flat. You know? I have found, and I found it with myself, I found it with my students, that when I exaggerate, then when I hear a recording of myself or when I get feedback from people who have listened to me, it starts to approach a little bit of what I want it to approach. If it's soft, you make your softs way softer. If it's loud, you make your louds way louder. The best analogy that I could probably give for this is a theater analogy. I'm a theater goer. I don't know if any of you guys are. I love theater. Have you ever been backstage before a show, before a musical or an opera or even a play, a stage play, and had access to any of the actors before they go on stage or maybe right after? They have so much makeup on that it's almost grotesque, actually. I mean, it almost looks... Well, it's just grotesque. It's not even human. There's so much makeup that's just caked on them. But that's up close. And when you are in the audience and you're 30, 40, 50 feet back from these people, all the exaggerated makeup and the grotesqueness of the makeup up close disappears, and it looks like normal flesh in the lights, and you're in the audience looking at them. Well, the analogy for this probably should be obvious, that what we feel like is oftentimes an exaggeration. To the people that are listening to us, it comes across as just right. You know, as just the right amount. So when you're at home practicing, the first musical thing that I would say for you to do, and what I have to do, is exaggerate way beyond what you think is, I mean, go overkill. You know, exaggerate, 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 and it probably actually will come across as being just about the right amount. Very few times have I been exaggerating, and then I've listened to a recording or someone, my wife or whoever, say, "Oh, what were you doing? That was weird." It never really comes across like that. The other thing that, you know, I've kind of had to realize, and you can think about this too, and it maybe can be a good tip for you, is that we usually practice in spaces that are much smaller than where we're going to play. You know, I have a living room that's about as big as the podium there. And my office at school is about as big as two of those podiums. And I have a grand piano tucked in there, and there's not much really more room for in the office than me and the piano. And if I keep eating the Dr. Pepper floats, I'm not going to be able to fit in there. Well, you know, when you're in that size of a room, what you play sounds good and full if it needs to, or sounds really soft, but you have to realize that your sanctuary, where you're going to be ministering to people, is usually a bigger size room than that, okay? So when you're practicing at home, you need to be playing with the sound and with the projection for where you're going to be playing and not where you are. Does that make sense? If you're playing a pianissimo in your little practice studio at home, well, if you're in a sanctuary that even seats 200 or 300, the people in the back aren't going to be able to hear you, right? And what seems awfully loud to you in your practice room is probably going to be a nice mezzo forte, you know, when you get into your hall. So that's just a little tip that you know, I've learned with. Again, this after Mary, it doesn't sound very spiritual, but I hope you guys understand that that's bathed in that. These are just a little bit more practical things that you can do. What do we have next on our list? We've got Think Like a Singer. I cannot sing other than carrying a tune. When I'm up there directing those pieces, if it looks like I'm moving my mouth, that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm moving my mouth and nothing else, because you don't want to hear me sing. I mean, I can match a pitch, but that's it. You know that the Bible teaches us not to be envious of any gift or anyone, and I usually am not. If there's one thing that I'm envious of, it's a good singer. More than anything else in the world, I wish I was a great singer, because I just love the human voice, and I envy people. I really do. It's envy. It's just simple envy. I envy folks that can get up and just sing. Man, I wish I could do that. I kind of get to do that through the piano and through the choir pieces that I write, but God just chose not to give me that instrument. I think one of the reasons why I love the human voice and why we all do is because it really is the most natural instrument. It's what we all possess, right? We can't all afford a Steinway piano, but we all, hopefully, unless there's, you know, a physical ailment, we all can use our voices. And I don't know if you've ever thought about this before. I didn't mess that up, did I, man? Is that okay?
I don't know that is.
All right. Well, I don't either. If it's broken, Mary did it. It was in the previous section. I didn't step on it. But I don't know if you've thought about this or not, but really all instruments strive to replicate the voice. They really do. Now think about that. How many times, if we have any instrumentalists in here that have played in an orchestra or have played in a band, how many times have you heard the band director look to the trombones and say, "Trombones, I need a big operatic, you know, Pavarotti kind of high sound here. Just sing that out, sing that out." How many times have you heard that? How many times, on the other hand, have you been in choir practice and your director has said, "Second altos, I need you to sound a little bit more like a bassoon here." Right? It just doesn't work that way, right? We're always trying to replicate the voice, right? Not the other way around. The one exception to that might be in jazz when you scat sing. You know, Louis Armstrong, when he's doing ba-doo, ba-doo, ba-doo bops, You know, okay, he might be kind of replicating what he does on his trumpet. But most of the time, we're trying to sound like the voice. When I was in school, I studied with a wonderful teacher at University of Colorado. His name is Andrew Cooperstock. He used to walk around the studio yelling, "Canto, canto, canto." Hope he never hears this and it's being recorded. Well, he doesn't speak Italian. He doesn't speak Italian, but canto is Italian for sing. And he was trying to tell me to make the piano sing and achieve a vocal quality. So if we all can agree that, you know, one of the ways we can kind of help reach people with our music and project ourselves is to make the piano sound more like a voice and less like a machine, which it really is, then how do we do that? How do we achieve a vocal quality at the piano? So that's what I want to kind of talk about a little bit right now. One of the things that we have at the piano, which singers don't have, we don't need a breath, right? We can play and play and play and play till the cows come home, and there's no need to take a breath. Well, do you know, there's just something in us. We need a breath. I mean, we need a musical breath. We need to hear that, you know, when we listen to people. And when we listen to singers, they have to take a breath, right? Pianists don't. And when we're not mindful of places to breathe musically, it can give our playing a little bit of a run-on quality or a little bit of a breathless quality. And I don't mean the adjective breathless in a good way, like, you know, a girl, "Oh, that guy leaves me breathless." I don't mean that. I mean a breathless, like it's someone that's just going on and never takes a break and blah, 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 blah. Right. So, one of the things that I do, if it's a melody that I'm playing, a classical melody, or if it's, you know, an arrangement like I'm getting ready for this recording, I sing the melody, and I look for those spots where I've got to breathe. And when I find those spots, I notice how long that little breath is. I played "There Is a Fountain" this morning. Da di da di da da di ya da ya da di. There was just a tiny little minuscule breath there. Well, I want to try to replicate that on the piano. Otherwise, I'm going to play la da di da da di da di da ya da di da di da di da da ya da di, and it just keeps on going, right? And it's not human. It's not natural. It's not how we operate. Does that make sense? You know, so it's kind of a good way to do this. So here's some exercises. Number one, you can write these down underneath "Think Like a Singer" if you wish. Sing through some simple melodies or hymns, observing where your natural breaths occur. More often than not, you're going to place your breath at the end of a phrase, and this is going to create a very minuscule but important little pause. Okay? I don't know if you realize this or not, but even people that say they're not musical, they're musical. Humans are just innately musical. I really do believe that. I think some people just have more trouble letting it come out. And I think that people they show their musicality the most with their voice, even though they might not be singers. So the second thing that I'm doing and that I have my students do is after you've done number one, after you've sung through the tune and looked for your breaths, I go through it one more time, and this time I just add little inflections to kind of personalize the melody a little bit more. So, da di da ya da di da ya di di da di ya da da di ya da. That's musical, right? It is. And so after I've done that, then I go to the piano and I make my students and I make myself just play the simple melody of a hymn, just a folk tune, whatever, that you've sung, and try to match your inflection right down to the fine point of what you sang. Okay? So, I can't believe that was I don't have perfect pitch. I'll pat myself on the back for that. I was singing it in B flat. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Brad Nicks. There's all sorts of little shadings that are in that wouldn't be if I'm just tune. Does that make sense? Now, you know, if you're playing a 10-minute classical piece, if you did that for every phrase, you'd be working on it till Christmas. So I don't know if I would encourage you to necessarily sing every single thing you play. But just doing a few measures can kind of get you, it can be enough to kick you into that realm of thinking vocally, thinking like a singer. Okay? So that's my third point, was after you had sung through the melody, and the first one was watching where your breaths are, and then the second was adding some inflections, then the third thing, and we're underneath C, is attempt to play that same melody without accompaniment. I didn't add anything to it, I just want to hear the melody. And strive to match every aspect of what you sing so naturally with your voice. And then the next step might be to add some simple accompaniment. That might be number four. I told you I'd give you a 10-step program in here. That might be number four, to try to retain that same vocal quality, but add some simple accompaniment. If it's an arrangement that you're playing, then you might play that melody in the right hand and start to put in some of the left hand. And you're paying attention to that melody to make sure it's inflected just the way that you sang it. Now, let's talk about there's other things we can do to kind of help our piano playing achieve a little bit more of a vocal quality. I'm to the point now, and I've kind of been able to do this just intuitively, and I'm sure you guys can too, because we're musicians, but I find that not everyone can. Not everyone can find the most beautiful, dramatic moments in a piece. And I see that a lot with students, and I don't know why they have trouble sometimes finding this. I don't know if it's the overall quality of the music they listen to is going down. I don't know. But one of the ways that I've been able to help people find the dramatic moments in music is look for the leaps. Okay, and let's take this back to singing again. If you find a leap in your score, and it doesn't have to be a big leap. It could be a leap of a fifth. It could be a leap of a seventh, a leap of an octave. But if you find a leap in your score, try to sing it, even if you're not a singer. And you're going to find something out. Leaps are harder to sing than steps. It's easier to go da-da than it is to go da-da and go up the octave, right? Well, not so on the piano. I mean, if you ask a singer to sing a tenth, which is basically, what, 8, 9, 10, well, 10 notes, hello, it's the end of the day. If you ask them to sing a tenth, they're going to do that very carefully. You know, there's drama there. Are they going to make that leap? They're starting low, and we know they're going high. Is it going to be in tune? Is it going to be beautiful? Is it going to be heroic? Are they going to make it? There's drama in kind of actually knowing if they're going to make it or not. But is that drama in a piano leap? Here's a tenth. Right, because it's so easy to make intervals on the piano, we forget how much drama there is in the voice when people sing intervals. Okay? That's why Somewhere Over the Rainbow is still, and for as long as God lets the world turn around, it's going to be a song that's always with us. Because it opens up with ya-da. You know, it's that opening leap that just has so much drama and emotion in it. Okay? So, when you locate large intervals, then when you play those intervals, think like a singer. Okay? You know, if I'm going to play Somewhere Over the Rainbow, let's see if we can figure what that is. Yeah, there we go. So if I'm going to play that, then I'm not going to go. Right? That's not showing anything that's there. But if I think like a singer, then, you know, you highlight that and you Does that make sense? Do you guys hear what I'm saying there? It's a subtle thing. That wasn't a humongous difference between probably the first way I played it, but I do believe it was enough of a difference to project a little bit more of the drama there and not just pass over it as if it's not a big deal, because it is a big deal. You can always find drama in the larger intervals. That's where drama is in music. I say the word drama, that's what one of my old teachers used to always say. He would never say a person was musical or not. He would always say, is there drama in their playing or not? And I thought, yeah, that kind of makes sense, because drama is what keeps us interested, you know, in things. Again, I know this seems like I'm kind of veering in more into performance than ministry. I promise I'm not. But these are things that's going to help you reach out and grab the hearts. Actually, I guess it's God that does that. But this is the kind of thing that you, with your preparation, can, you know, better help you be a better vehicle for the Holy Spirit. Okay. Now, number seven, that was six, about looking for large intervals and then singing them. Number seven, listen to a lot of vocal music. This is a kind of a fun thing that you can do away from the piano. And all this is still under the umbrella of think like a singer. And this is, in fact, the final point that I have. But listen to a lot of vocal music. There is something about listening to, whether it's opera, whether it's Broadway musicals, which I love, there's just something about listening to the human voice and getting that sound in your ear that I think helps us project ideas as musicians more vocally. Okay, and I'm sure most of us probably do that. But if you're a pianist, don't just listen to piano music. Don't just listen to instrumental. Really find good vocal music and always be listening to it. And now that I've kind of pointed out some of these things, start to pay attention to them. Listen how singers approach leaps, right? They won't just gloss over them, particularly if it's a big leap. You know, listen to how they pace their breathing. Right, and these are the kind of things then that you start to think about applying, you know, to the melodies that we play at the piano, right? And it can kind of help us move there a little bit better. I was glad to hear. Let's move on to D. Know the words. I was glad to hear Mary talk about this a little bit. It's hard for me to interpret a song at all if there aren't any words. I don't know if any of you were in the round table composer discussion that we had at lunch, but someone asked where, you know, did inspiration come for all of the composers that were in the room. And I don't think I could ever be an instrumental composer, because for me it comes from the words. It really does. And even when I'm doing a piano arrangement, which is an instrumental piece, I'm thinking about the words, you know. And so if you're playing some kind of a hymn arrangement or any kind of arrangement of a tune, you want to have those words really ingrained in you. And that can very much help. That's also a trick that I learned from my years playing jazz. One of the things that jazz musicians have, this is just an old tip that jazz musicians have always passed along, is that, okay, if you're going to improvise on Body and Soul it was a Clint Eastwood movie. Play Misty for Me. If you're going to improvise on that, you know, whatever, make sure that you got the words. You know, make sure you know the words, because that's, even jazz musicians know this. So, you know, church musicians should certainly know that. What happens if there aren't any words? You become a lyricist and make them up. I'm not kidding. If I'm lying, I'm dying. I when I did my junior recital, I played a collection of pieces called Papillon by Schumann. It's translated into Butterflies. Have you played that? Do you know Papillon?
I'm playing one of the early intermezzos from it.
Okay, cool. You know what? I was playing it flat. And even I knew it was flat. I mean, when you know you're not playing it with a lot of personality, it's really bad. It's, you know, kind of like, you know, when you can smell yourself, you know, what, imagine what other people are smelling. Well, even I knew this thing just was flat. Well, my teacher told me, go and write words for it. And I did. I took the score and I wrote in lyrics for every one of the 12, 13, 14 Papillon that were there. Now, they were ridiculous lyrics. And, I mean, they were comical and things that I would never share with anyone. But you know what? It made a difference in how I played those things over. It really did, because I'm just such a word animal, and it gave me something to hang on to. So, you know, if you're playing something, you know, like Heather Sorensen writes a lot of good originals, like Beautiful, you know, in the Simply Beautiful book, and other pianists do that. If you're playing just an original melody from some arranger or composer that has no words, make some up. They won't mind. You know, just make them up and be thinking those words. They don't have to be great. They don't have to rhyme. It's just something about having some kind of word to associate with the text, which can make all the difference. At least it did for me. Repertoire and role playing. I'm cruising through this because I'm going to get to probably what's the biggest bear for most of us, which is memorize. I love for people to play things from memory. And I know that once we're a few years out of school, we kind of let that, you say, thank goodness I never have to play anything by memory again. But every now and then, if we can, I think it's good for us. So I'm cruising through these because I'm going to spend some time there. One of the things that can kind of, I think, jumpstart our musical personality a little bit when we feel like we're kind of playing a little flat is to play repertoire that's outside of what we normally would do. You know, we all have music that's in our comfort zone that we like. Mine happens to be either kind of soft and meditative or quiet or some kind of jazz thing. Well, every now and then I need to play a calypso. You know, and if you're a very quiet, introspective player, playing something that's really loud and heroic and, you know, is going to bring down the roof like Mary would play is great for you. On the other hand, if you play a lot of loud, you know, virtuosic, you know, stuff like Joe or Mary would, then try to play something really simple and quiet. You know, just do something totally different from what you usually would do, and that can help you. Role playing. What do you think I mean by role playing? Isn't that what's next on the list? This might seem a little bit odd to you, but I promise people do this. I've done it with my students. I've done it. You know, and it seems a little bit out of place because we're in a discussion right now about how to bring out and project your, you know, ministry and your musicality and your gifts. And yet I'm about to start talking about role playing, which is pretending to be someone else, right? But as an exercise, it's always very fun to sit at the piano and say, I'm going to play at Calvary, and I'm going to play it the way Mary McDonald does it. I'm going to just play Mary McDonald for a minute. Now, are you going to be Mary McDonald? No. You know, but there's something about imagining musicians and ministers that you respect and look up to and would like to emulate and to think like that when you play. I can't tell you how many times I've done that. It really helps. It seems a little off the wall. I know it does. It seems a little off the wall, but it helps. I love Billy Joel. I do. I'm the. If he's the angry young man, I'm the satisfied middle-aged man. I just look, it makes sense, and we'll move on from it. But I love Billy Joel, and I used to play in a lot of rock bands. And gosh, I would always, how would Billy Joel play this? I'm gonna kind of just pretend it helps kind of bump you into that zone. How many of us still memorize music? Oh, you do, for sure. Yeah, he's a performance major here. I gotta tell you guys, ladies and gentlemen, if the Spirit would so move in your life that you would decide to try to memorize a piece, even if it's not every piece you play, but if you play an offertory, and hopefully it's offertories, you know if you play them really bad, they're offertories. But if you're not playing an offertory and you're playing an offertory, that's like when I was in college. You know, everyone wants to play Clair de Lune. You know, it's just like Moonlight Sonata. Every piece, every pianist just has to play it. And so what happens is students beg their teachers, "Oh, please let me play Clair de Lune." And you know, the teachers who are wanting to keep happy students will say, "Okay, you can play it." And sometimes they might be playing it maybe a little earlier than they should be playing. It's a hard piece. And so we used to have a joke at Colorado that, you know, we'd hear all these people playing Clair de Lune, and if they weren't playing it very well, we'd say they were playing Clair the Saloon. So we would never wanted to play Clair the Saloon. We wanted to play Clair de Lune. But anyway, if you can memorize a piece, even if it's just every now and then, if you play an offertory every Sunday, then maybe make it a goal once every month or once every 3 months to get up there and play something from memory, it helps your musicality. Because there's nothing that can stifle your projection of a piece, like Mary said, than being locked in, you know, to what's going on the page. So if you can get away from that, it's going to be helpful. Now, the question is, I don't know when the last time, you know, you guys have had to actively work with memorizing. How do you memorize a piece? I'll finish up here today with this, and I'll talk for about 10 minutes with it, and I'll take any questions or answers. But that's such a scary thing for folks. You know, you might have a memory of where you've played from memory and things fell apart, and, you know, you thought, my gosh, once I get away from this piano, I'll never come up here without music again. How do you memorize something? Let me know. What do you think?
I used to do it like last 4 measures, last 8 measures, last,
Okay.
16 measures.
So you start from the end and then move forward, yeah. You know, I think the problem with most memory is that we rely on muscle memory, you know, and not any other kind of memory. And there's all sorts of types of memory. There's intellectual memory, there's muscle memory, there's probably a few others I can't think of. Tying your shoe is a great example of muscle memory. Do you know, I'm 37 years old, I've been almost 38, I've been tying my shoe now for a few years. And I have a four-year-old who's wanting to start to learn to tie her shoe. Her name is Sarah. And so she came up and asked me to help her tie her shoe, and I said, you bet, darling, I'm gonna show you. And the minute I had to start thinking about how you tie your shoe and which way you go and you loop this, and I'm 37 years old. I couldn't tie my shoe just for a minute. So I had to look away, talk to Patty, my wife, you know, get onto another conversation and just let my hands do it. And, oh, that's how you tie your shoe. How many times have you been playing the piano by memory, you know, if you can think back to it, when you were memorizing, and you're looking at these two hands, somehow they're doing something, and they're playing notes, but you have no idea where they're going, where they've been, or where they're supposed to go. And the minute that something gets derailed, it's over. You can't find a way to get back in. You have to go back to the beginning and start. Does that, you guys, I've been there. You know, I'm sure you guys have too. So the trick with memory is that we have to start to use other types of memory other than muscle, okay? The first thing that I always do, and you can't do this with every piece you play, I know that. I can't do it with every piece I play nowadays. He can, because he's practicing probably 10 hours a day. But the first thing that I do is when I decide I'm going to memorize a piece, I learn it hands alone. Start to finish. This is the Bach F sharp minor prelude from book 2. It's been probably 10 years since I've played that piece. But I practiced it so much hands alone that I can still do it. I could do the left hand too. Right, this is the left hand. And in fact, what do you want to talk about? Because I can carry on the conversation with you, and I'm not going to miss a note on this piece. It's Bach, it's scary, and I was scared to death of it, and I went to that trouble to memorize it. Well, if you can memorize, get to the point where you can play hands alone from start to finish, the right hand of an offertory, and then the left hand of an offertory, you're going to get it. You'll be amazed. It takes a lot of work. But see, the problem is with playing both hands together is when we're relying on muscle memory, our hands cue one another. What my right hand does cues the left, and what the left hand does cues the right. And then when one hand gets off, the other hand, which is relying on cues from this hand, no longer can function because this hand's out of commission, and you got nowhere to go but to stop, right? So when you memorize things hand separate, then you've begun to put a little bit of intellectual thought into what's going on, and if one hand gets derailed, the other hand really can keep on going until you find a place to get the other hand back in. Does that make sense? Okay. Let me give you another way. Mary mentioned Schroeder from Charlie Brown. I tell you what, a great way to learn to memorize is Schroeder-style piano. You know, we talk about how great Joe Martin is and how great Mary McDonald is. Has there ever been a pianist, really, that's better than Schroeder? That dude comes to the piano, and he's playing with one hand, and somehow or another, we hear, right? And he's all doing it just like this. He's just like a genius. I don't know how he does it. So if we can kind of, you know, copy Schroeder with our memory, that helps. What do I mean by that? Let's go back to my little prelude example. Believe it or not, I took my second finger, Schroeder style, and I sat there and played every note of that prelude. Could do it with the left hand too. Now this is Bach, so sometimes each hand is having to play more than one voice, so if there's a couple of voices that's going on in the right hand, I use my left hand to kind of help out. That seems like overkill. You guys are thinking, why in the world would I ever subject myself to that? But the reason why it works so well is because it's just another way of getting rid of muscle memory. You know, you have to consciously think, okay, I'm on this note. What's the next note? It's this one. And then I have to go here. And when you break up fingering like that, it's kind of a way to help with that. You could do other kind of fun things if you wanted to. I could play the the right hand maybe with my left hand. Right, and try that, you know, and that might be something that, you know, could kind of help. I'm just throwing out different memory ideas here because I feel so strongly that it's to get off the page is such a, if you can force yourself to do it every now and then, it's so worthwhile. You know, one thing that I've always loved to do is to play one hand and air play the other or tap it on here. I don't know why. It's just a goofy little thing, but it works. If I'm playing the left hand while I'm playing the right, I have no idea why. I think I do too know why. Because I'm not really pressing a key with my left hand, and I'm having to imagine what keys are being pressed with the left hand. And so it kind of gets my mind jump-started where I can kind of think what those notes are, you know, when you start to play both hands together. So that's kind of a cool thing to do. And then a few other quick little things. We probably all grew up with memory stations. That's what my teacher called them. You know, I would go through a piece of music and have little stations. You know, I would, on my score, I would number them. Station 1, 2, 3, 4. And the deal was that, you know, if I'm playing the piece of music and something breaks down, then rather than having to go back to the beginning, I have a spot I can jump to. That was a station. You know, and if I manage to play through that spot, then if something break down after that, rather than going back, I'd have another spot that I could jump to, right? Does this, if you've been in piano lessons ever, even though it might have been a few years ago, these things are probably starting to ring some bells. You know, and if you're a teacher, you know, these are probably things that you work with all the time anyway, you know, when you're getting your students ready for recitals. So I would, you know, encourage you, if you can, to kind of bite the bullet and memorize. I think those are the points that I had. I wanted to talk about thinking like a singer. I wanted to talk about memorizing. I wanted to talk about maybe repertoire and what you can do with that. I think, what was the first one that we talked about? I can't remember. Know the words. We covered that. Exaggeration and praying and preparing. That's all I have for today. Do we have any questions? You know, anything that I can kind of help you with? Yes?
You had on your reverse hand.
Oh, reverse hands. Did I not talk about that?
No.
This is a sadistic little thing. A lot of times, not all pieces warrant themselves with this, but there have been times, you know, this morning I played my arrangement of There Is a Fountain. But, you know, if you're a piano teacher or you're a piano player, you got to be a little sadistic. You know, there's just something in you that comes out with that. You know what? It's all just ways of kind of getting the music a little bit more ingrained intellectually. Now, when I'm playing, am I thinking that? Oh, no. I mean, our brains, at least my brain, isn't capable of thinking where everything is going. When I'm playing, and I'm playing from memory pretty well, I'm on autopilot. My fingers are just doing their thing. But the reason we go through all of that is when something does happen, we can wake our brains up and we can save the day without it falling apart. And then once you get damage control and things are back to normal, then go back to autopilot and enjoy the piece and, you know, focus on projecting what it is that you want to project. So, okay, what else? Any other kind of questions?
With memorizing, do you think it helps just to know the song, the chordal?
You know, I think it does help. I've never memorized that way, but I know a lot of people do. I know a lot of people do. You know, a lot of people will think, okay, the harmony that's going on here is D minor, and then I'm going to a G7 chord, and then I need to get to a C chord. I know a lot of people memorize that way. I never have, but I'm sure it's absolutely helpful to do that. Yeah, absolutely. You had a question. Okay.
So I want to make a comment. You know, during the reading session, sometimes I'll just quit singing and I just listen to the pianist.
Sure.
And it's an incredible job.
Steve is phenomenal.
That, I mean, for years. Uh-huh. I guess he's done it for a long time here.
Yeah.
But he does it very vocally.
He does.
Very vocally.
That's exactly right.
And he'll hesitate on certain, you know, because we tend to do when we're playing for a choir, mm-hmm. you don't take a lot of liquid
He does, and if you listen to him, he'll hold back and he'll speed up. It's very vocal.
I've heard pages far in one night, and he does not play the notes that are on the page necessarily.
And that's okay.
And that's wonderful.
That's
and I was
okay.
listening to him today remembering that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's still at it.
Yeah. And you know, I know you guys know this because you know Steve and you're Texans. Other, I guess maybe probably most people in here are, but he's the director of the Houston Children's Chorus. And so he spends his life working with singers.
Yeah.
You know,
and you can tell he does. He brings out the vocal part and just the different little stylistic things
mm-hmm.
he'll do that I thought, oh, that is so cool.
That's right. It is cool.
It's just neat to know just to quit singing and just listen.
And just to listen. That's exactly right. That's excellent. Yes, ma'am.
I just had one question. Memorize the number 6 is visualize the score.
Uh-huh.
Do you take it in sections or how?
Gosh, I didn't. I'm sorry. I didn't say that. You know, visualizing is something that it probably is the final test of how well you know a piece. When I play something by memory, if I'm going to have to perform, and I don't perform that much anymore, but when I really did, and you know, I wanted to do a good job, I would practice as much away from the piano as I would at the piano. And I would, you know, get my music and I would sit at a desk. I used to love to do it when I, you know, was lying in bed in my college dorm room. If I could get my, you know, roommate to, you know, not be partying, I went to Georgia State, which, so, yeah, sometimes they party a little bit. But, you know, if I could find some quiet, then I would lie in bed and visualize my right hand playing every note of a certain piece. You know, there is a fountain, okay, which, you know, I played this morning. Right hand, I can see in my mind my right hand playing a B-flat, going to an A, going to a C, going to an A, to a G, to a B-flat, to a high G, to an F. I can just see my hand trickling right down. I can see my left hand starting on an E-flat, going to a B-flat, a G, E-flat above middle C, F, and G.
So are you visualizing the notes, or are you visualizing...
In my mind, I see a picture of my hand playing those notes.
Yeah.
But it could be different for everyone. That's just what works for me.
Heather Sorensen tells a story of before her senior recital,
uh-huh.
she was hospitalized,
okay.
and she had to memorize her music from her hospital bed.
It can be done. And you know, let me tell you this. I'll tell you another story, too. I forget who it is. It might be Ian Hobson. Ian Hobson is a phenomenal pianist who teaches at University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. I think it might be in now. You know, it might not be, and I know we're recording this, so if it's not in, I apologize, but I think it is. Ian is a British pianist, and of course he's been in America now for quite a few years, but there is a story of when he was living in England that some pianist was booked to play a concerto with an orchestra here in America, and the pianist became just deathly ill and couldn't do it, and they asked him if he would do it. He had not played the piece. He memorized it on the plane on the way home. Okay. Now, I don't know if that was Ian. If it wasn't Ian, I apologize. But there is a story that is true of some pianists doing that. Okay. So you know, our developing the ability to practice away from the piano and to visualize these things—that's in some ways just as valuable as sitting here. And boy, if there's ever a way to kind of get rid of muscle memory, it's that. Because I'm sitting there, I'm not even moving in my fingers, I'm just imagining the notes in my mind. And you'll come across little spots where it gets kind of cloudy, and you can't visualize what those notes are. Well, that's the spots where you might not know it as well as you think you do. And you go and study the score and play it until you can visualize it, you know, without all that stuff becoming cloudy. Yes? Oh, I thought you had, okay. What else? I know you guys are thinking, oh my gosh, this guy... Brad, you need to get a life. Well, I don't really do this stuff anymore. But, you know, when I was in college, I did. And I have my students do it. And every now and then, I will still do it. Because I just know when I can get away from the book, I can do the other things that I talked about, like exaggerating and thinking about the words. And I can do all those things better when I'm not locked into the score. So, anything else?
I have trouble deciding whether... I'm playing from memory or playing by ear.
Yeah.
What? Where's the line there?
Right. Right.
I have no trouble. I can't play
from memory. Okay. So somebody.
You know, I wonder if Mary struggles with that because she is so gifted at playing by ear, and particularly with her history of being an ear player first and then reading after that.
Really young, like she did. I started when I was 5.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm 73 years old. I've been doing this a long time.
Sure, yeah.
I have something interesting to share. I have never been able to memorize piano. I never was a piano major or minor.
Sure.
I've taken lessons all along my life. But I have recently been learning how to play the harp.
Oh, wow.
And I find it much easier to memorize on the harp. And like you were saying, the chord things, mm-hmm. I would never be able to do that on the piano. But wow. I might even do it on the harp, memorize the chord structures.
That's so neat.
Oh, wow.
That's neat.
Especially if you transfer to the piano.
Yeah, very good. Well, you know, memory is a muscle. And the more you use it, it does get stronger. And the less you use it, it starts to atrophy a little bit. You know, it really is a muscle.
You know, when you think about it, when you're turning the page, you've memorized that last measure that you're turning. Now, that's always, you know, don't stop and think about it, because then it'll mess you up.
Yeah. Right.
And I was like, well, I can memorize a measure. That's
good. Yep. And the other thing I'll throw out, and I know we're probably over time here, but the other thing I will throw out that I probably should have prefaced all these kind of things with the memorization is you don't want to bite off the whole piece at the beginning.
Oh.
You know, I mean, that's a mistake I've seen myself make and I've seen my students make, that they sit down in one practice session and they've got a 2 or 3 page piece, and their goal is to memorize the entire right hand from start to finish in one practice session. Oh, no. See, our brains can't process that. You know, what you do is work in small sections, and this week I'm going to memorize 8 measures. You know, if you haven't memorized in a while, the more you memorize, you'll start to do it more quickly. You might could memorize a whole piece in a week. But you start off with whatever is a small amount for you to digest and chew, and then you gradually add to that. So with all these memory things, the worst mistake you could make would be to try to do, you know, Schroeder style or whatever, and bite off a large amount to memorize. It's overkill. You know, our brains just can't process that. We have to work with smaller bits. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Another question. Like, you know, you said challenge yourself to memorize like an offertory once a month or something.
Yeah.
But there's a fear in, you know, forgetting something when you're up there. And that's why, you know, feeling, having the music there.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That's a little security.
Right. You know, I think it goes with the territory a little bit, and I'm not sure if that ever goes away. You know, when I was memorizing a lot, and you might could speak to this better because he's a senior performance major here, so I'm sure he's memorizing a lot. I the fear of a memory slip never went away, but what helped me was because of the preparation I had done, I knew that I could control it if a memory slip happened. So it wasn't that the fear ever went away, it's just I felt confident that, okay, if something does go wrong, I know this piece well enough that I can do some damage control, and hopefully not too many people are going to know. Okay? So, you know, the more you actively work to prepare your memory, I won't say it's going to make your fear of having a memory slip go away, but you'll feel more confident that you can handle it if one happens.
Well, so what do you do? Just doodle around what you've done.
Mm-hmm. If you're able to, you know, if the memory slip was in the left hand, try to keep that right hand going. If you can, try to keep the left hand going. If you can, you know, if you've kind of created some spots in the music where you've got some what I call memory stations, you can jump to that spot. I tell you what, when I used to play a piece called the Chromatic Fantasy and Fugue, and I apologize if we're over. I'll sit here and talk to you until, you know, everyone leaves. But this is a major Bach piece. I mean, it's got 400 measures of pure terror. You know, I mean, when you're trying to memorize that, I don't know if it's quite that long, but it's long. Well, I had about 7 or 8 memory spots, you know, throughout maybe each page of the piece. And I would sit there with my friends, and I would be playing along, and I would ask my friends just to randomly call out a memory spot. And they'd say, 7. And all of a sudden, I'd jump to number 7.
Oh,
3.
Those were those spots.
Yeah, those spots. And all of a sudden, I'd jump to memory spot 3. 1. I'd go back to the beginning, right, because that's where 1 is. And you know, when I exercise, I mean, it takes a lot of performance fear away because you know you can get through it. Now, it might not be perfect, but you just know it's not going to be a train wreck where you have to stop and go back to the beginning, or worse yet, just stare at the piano. You know, so it just builds up your confidence in how you handle it, you know, when things happen.
I'll share a story, and then I'll try to make it short. I was the organist at Eglin Air Force Base years ago, and I was I was doing a really, really neat prelude. Offertory. I was playing for mass.
Okay.
And I didn't get lost. I just made a big mistake.
Right.
And threw me into a different key without modulating, and I just started messing around with what I was doing.
Yeah.
Nothing came to my mind, so my fingers started playing. And after mass, I thought, my Lord in heaven, I played beer barrel polka for mass.
Well, if the people there could recognize it, and they were in no place to judge you.
It was a corral. Oh, Lord Jesus.
Hey, guys, thank you so much for coming. I get a...
Thank you.
You bet. I've got another session coming up with lead sheets, and I'd love to have all of you here. I know that's kind of something that scares a lot of people.